This is BBC.
BBC Radio.
Six
music. Right now, it's Matt Everett's The First Time with The XX.
Then we crystallize, and you've got the faith that I could bring paradise.
I'll forgive and forget before I'm paralyzed. Do I have to keep up the pace to keep you satisfied?
I've gotten closer to the sun, and I've done things in small doses. So don't think that I'm pushing you away when you're the one that I've kept closest. I.
Hello, I'm Matt Everett, and welcome to The First Time. This is the series where we meet some of the most influential and best-loved musicians around and look at the seminal first musical moments that shaped their lives and their careers. This episode features not just one musician, but a whole band, which is slightly different for the series, but that feels kind of fitting, because this band are slightly different. They formed in 2005, but this year marks the 10th anniversary of their debut album, and that album absolutely defined the 12 months that followed after it was released. In fact, maybe even longer. It's now so familiar, this record, that it's hard to remember that no one had really heard a record like it, with that atmosphere, with those arrangements, with these dual vocals and that beautiful production. It broke the group in the US and was featured on countless TV shows and films and went on to win the Mercury Prize. Two more brilliant records followed, as did huge success, some amazing tours, festival headlining slots and worldwide acclaim. And while they rarely do interviews where they look back to their past, they're doing it for us. My guests on The First Time this week are The XX. So here the whole band, Romy Madley Croft, Oliver Sim and Jamie XX, discuss the whole of their career, their influences, forming the group and recording that famous debut album. We also chat about the difficulties they face when they were recording the follow-up, dealing with the attention that success brings, and it's fair to say they're not a band who were initially comfortable with that attention, but also how the live performances have evolved, and they even talk about new material. But the first question I ask the band, as I do with all my guests, when was the first time they were aware of music as a child?
I grew up in like a household where it was just a lot of... neither my mum or dad are musicians, but they're definite music lovers. So there was always music playing. Like my mum used to clean the house to the VHS of Talking Heads, Stop Making Sense.
That's a strong...
It's a really strong
a
one.
Choice.
You know, David Byrne was this, like, cartoon character of a man to me, with, like, huge shoulders and a tiny head, which I thought was really fun. Definitely like a family of music lovers, so there was always music playing in the home.
Yeah. Mm. Jamie, was it a lot of Stax and soul for you? Is that right?
Yeah. The first record I remember like being obsessed with and like studying the cover of was a live Stax gig from the early 70s, I think. With like everybody on it, Otis Redding and Booker T and the MGs and Sam and Dave, and I'm sure that it's been played too much now to listen to again, but I have it somewhere.
Were you that? Did you sit and were you one of those kids that would study every note and every word and picture of the sleeves?
I mean, no, I wasn't really reading it. I was just like looking at all the little pictures because there was little pictures all over it of every band on it, and yeah, it was amazing.
How about you?
Yeah, really similar. I think with me, my parents were really big fans of music. Not musicians, but just so many records always at home. And my dad would always put on a record at dinner time and we'd listen to it rather than talk, which I didn't realise was not the most conventional family setup. Most people have a chat. But yeah, so that it kind of taught me through listening.
I like that kind of thing about, like, yeah, it's record time now.
Yeah. It didn't feel as formal, but I realised it was quite a ritual that a vinyl would go on and then we'd just sort of eat and I would be listening to it.
What can you remember being some of the big...
I think Jimi Hendrix was playing a lot, and I really have a lot of strong memories of listening to Little Wing and being, like, really blown away.
That's a good song.
It's a beautiful song. So that was, he was a really big fan, but a lot of classics, but always really eclectic. I think that's what we all share, is that we've grown up with lots of eclectic music.
Yeah.
I definitely came to your house for dinner and Madonna's Ray of Light was playing.
Yes. Yeah, no, that was great. My dad, he liked to go through the collections of people's music. So we went from, you know, so we went through Ray of Light and then I came down to Confessions on a Dance Floor once and was just like, yes, I was loving it. You know, he was like, okay, so what happened next after Ray of Light? And it goes slightly more poppy. But yeah, that was fun.
What about the first time that you owned or bought or got hold of music that you were like, this is mine, thank you for that influence, but this is, I have chosen this for me because it speaks to me?
I think it's a bit blurry for me. I have an older sister. And, you know, as a younger sibling, you just steal their stuff.
True.
And I couldn't steal her clothes, though I tried. I stole her music, and the album that I would, like, routinely steal and she would always try and get back off of me was The Miseducation of Lauryn Hill, which to this day is still one of my, like, favourite records. Because I listen to it now and I still feel that kind of same excitement of just being, like, 13 or, like, even 12. And I went to go and see her live for the first time.
What was it like? Wow.
I felt like a teenager. And, you know, it's nice to access that kind of excitement.
Yeah.
You know, as I've gotten older, I, like, digest music in a different way, which is kind of less obsessive and a bit more based in, like, reality, I think. But it was really a really special experience. But that was the first record that I really, like, fell in love with.
Yeah.
I don't know how it, like, translates into the kind of music we make, but it was, like, my first album that I was truly obsessed with. It could all be so simple, but you rather make it hard. Loving you is like a battle.
forgives or reciprocity.
What about your first obsession that was your choice then?
I definitely inherited or just stole my parents' records, but the first thing I remember really wanting was, it was at Easter, and I asked my parents, instead of chocolate eggs, could I have a copy of Now 41? And it was quite a big deal for me, because I also loved chocolate. Still do. And I was obsessed with that record. I listened to it so much. It had, like, the Cardigans on it and Fatboy Slim and that whole era of stuff.
And was that, like... Those are good records, those were, because you got that wonderful snapshot. It's like, it's a playlist, basically, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's the kind of tally to it. What were the tunes on that that got heavy?
I think Praise You, Fatboy Slim was the big one.
The electronic music, was that the first hint of, like, well, it doesn't have to be a band?
Yeah, well, I don't even think I was thinking in those terms. I didn't really think about the fact that it was made on a computer or right. anything like that. I liked how strange it was and how different it sounded from all the music that I'd been listening to up until then, which was just my parents' records from the 70s.
Yeah. And your obsession... That was yours?
I have a really strong memory of buying, going to visit my grandma in Portsmouth and going to Woolworths. Is that what, yeah?
It is, yeah. It's yeah. no more. No more. Woolworths has gone. famous pick and mix.
I bought a cassette of Run DMC versus Jason Nevins. It's Like That, because I'd seen it on Top of the Pops at Oliver's house. And I think the music video was like, there was a lot of dancing.
Not break dancing.
Yeah. I was like, this is cool. So I bought it on cassette and I loved it. Which is quite funny as my first cassette. But yeah, it stands up.
It stands up.
And it goes a little something like this.
First gig you went to that really made an impression then?
First gig I went to that definitely probably changed everything for me was the Distillers at Brixton Academy, supported by Peaches, Eagles of Death Metal and Pretty Girls Make Graves.
That's a good lineup.
And I was there from the very beginning of the night through to the end, and I watched everyone. And I had most of the gig with some random guy with his arm around my neck. Like, and I was just like, please get off me. Mm-hmm. Like, in the mosh pit, it was like I had a full rounded experience. But it was amazing. It was like so much and so many incredible women up there, and like it just blew my mind.
Was that one of the ones when it was like, that I don't quite know how I can do that, but that's the sort of thing I want to do?
I just loved it. There's no way I ever thought about being one of those people on the stage, though. One of those people. No, I was just happy to be there and be in the crowd and soak it all up, but which made us doing this residency we did at Brixton Academy so special, because for all of us, we had such like incredible experiences at Brixton Academy early on. That was my first... I was 14, and I went with my friend from school, and we had the best time.
It's a good venue. First gig, Jamie?
And one of the first ones... I mean, definitely, like, the most memorable from back then was going to Brixton Academy as well and seeing the White Stripes with Ollie and his mum. And we were, like, right at the front. His mum was behind us, protecting us from the rest of the crowd, crushing us against the barriers.
Mosh barrier mum.
Yeah.
Nice.
And also she was moshing as hard as everyone else.
That was my first gig. My mum is a huge White Stripes fan. I think in her 40s, she suddenly had this... At the same time I was falling in love with music, she was re-falling in love with music. And she was just being an absolute teenager. And I think she really saw me as just, like, her friend. Because her friends didn't want to go to gigs.
Yeah.
And, you know, she wanted to go to gigs. She wanted to get right to the front so she could make eye contact with Jack White. So she... Yeah, she took me to my first gig, which was the White Stripes at Brixton Academy. It was during the Elephant album. And she took me to my first festival. She took me and Romy, and again...
to Reading.
Reading. It was the White Stripes playing on the main stage, and she wanted to get there 4 hours early so she could get right to the front. Me and Romy, who were about, like, 13, were just like, oh, I just don't have the energy.
She stayed through Dropkick Murphys.
Yeah, Dropkick Murphys.
To watch in the mosh pit. So good.
Mum's a real legend.
Yeah.
So I had this relationship with my mum where we were just, like, trading music a lot. And it was really fun. She was my gig buddy.
That's amazing. I'm getting quite emotional. It's such a lovely thing to do. What's the White Stripes track that we should play for your mum then?
Oh, probably Hardest Button to Button. I think, yeah, I can picture my mum getting down to that song. We started living in an old house. Mama gave birth and we were checking it out. It was a baby boy, so we bought him a toy. It was a Raycon, and it was 1981. We named him Baby. He had a toothache. He started crying. It sounded like an earthquake. It didn't last long because I stopped it.
Do another first. These are all firsts. The first time you sung together, because the sort of story, the nice story is that it was like you didn't even realise that each other enjoyed singing, and then you sung together. Oh right, okay. So we both like this. Is that true, or is that a bit of a?
It's true.
It's
true. Sweet.
Yeah, no, it's true. I guess a bit of a backstory to that is that Oliver and I met when we were 3 years old, and I guess we learned to speak at the same sort of time, and we were sort of learning it in that way. And then at about 14, both went through a stage of falling in love with music, going to these gigs and not really thinking about doing it, for me at least, myself. And then I started playing the guitar and I started singing, but it was really not an ambitious thing. It just felt good, but I wasn't really sure why. It kind of reached a point where I think Oliver and I sort of were talking and sort of like, I think I like singing. And I think I like singing. I was like, what? And, you know, being best friends and normally know most things about each other, I think it was kind of like, oh, this is new. And so I think it was a really out of shyness, a sense of you go first. No, I'm not going first. You go first. So I think we just sang at the same time. I have a memory of being in your living room. And we've never tried to fit our voices. I don't really know still yet how to harmonise. That's still a new, you know, finding the counter notes. But we just sing and it sounds the way it does.
Don't worry about why, just okay. carrying on doing it, it's working out well.
Thank you.
Because you had uncles that were DJs, is this right? I wanted to talk about the first time that you played out or performed in front of people.
You know, my uncles were both DJs, one in New York and one on Kiss in the North. And they gave me my first turntables when I was like 10.
When you were 10?
Yeah.
Yow.
They basically gave me their old ones. And a few records to learn to mix with. And then I basically just did that in my bedroom for a long time. And eventually, I think on MySpace, somebody invited me to play at Camden Lock at this little bar. And that was my first gig in front of people. But, I mean, nobody was really listening, but it felt big for me.
Can you remember how you felt? Because it's a big jump from the bedroom to eating a pub with about four or five people drinking Snakebite in Camden.
Yeah.
It's still a big deal.
Yeah, it was. It was terrifying. But I don't know, something was pushing me to do it.
And how about your first performance and your first kind of gig?
Our first gig was in Bournemouth. It was in Bournemouth. And it was a gig we'd gotten through our MySpace.
It's amazing hearing that. It just seems like the MySpace.
It really is, yeah.
So long ago.
So long ago. Oh, a lot to MySpace, actually. Yeah. Do you know, it really did us well. And we were, it was at a time where we were trying to like self-promote. So we were making CDs of, you know, the collection of songs we had and just sending them out to people we thought were interesting. And we were doing our own artwork. And we caught fish. We got a gig. And it was in Bournemouth. So we took the coach down and it was in a men's club. It was part of, like, a day festival, and we were first on. There was probably, like, fifteen if we're pushing
15
it. Everyone was seated as well.
Oh, great. It's really vibey space.
Yeah.
I feel like all the lights were on as well.
All the lights were on. It was daylight as well, so all the windows were open. It was terrifying. It really was. Some people just have it in their blood, and they're just like, the moment they step up on stage, it just really is in them. That's not us. That's really not us. I was just like, I figured out what shoegaze meant. You know, I was staring at my feet. I could feel my leg really shaking. I think about that, and I think, why did we like persevere as much as we did? Because it was like, it was a painful experience. You know, I wasn't enjoying it. But I felt like it was something I had to do. But I think we both did.
Yeah.
And this was before Jamie was in the band.
Yeah.
So we were playing to a CD of beats. And we would say before each song, we'd say, excuse me, Mr. Soundman, track two. And then there would be like a four beat click and then start playing.
Nick. Just ways to fly, easy to take. You could take me in 4 hours, make me a deal. Day a piece, take it all, just stay a week.
I'll take you in pieces, we can take it all apart. I've suffered shipwrecks right from the start. I've been underwater, breathing out and in. I think I'm losing where you end and I begin.
Basic space, open air. Don't look away when there's nothing there.
I'm setting us in stone.
So why do you think you kept doing it, if it was that difficult?
It's a question that has been coming up for us, I think. There was just something in it. I think at that moment in time, all the bands that I don't know, it seemed like people just played live. I think nowadays it seems a little bit different. Like you can put a song online and instantly get some interest, and then suddenly it happens quite quickly. But I don't know, back then MySpace was a really big part of it, and a lot of bands were playing small gigs in London, and it just felt like you played live. And now, I wonder if we'd started now as teenagers, whether we would have not done that. I don't know. But I'm really glad we did it, because it took hundreds of gigs, but then I think finally started to really love it.
Hundreds before you enjoyed it?
Yeah. There was always something there, but I think especially till I personally think I started to look like I enjoyed it. Hundreds of gigs. but now, like, I really love it. And and it's been a year now since we've played, and I really miss it. So that feels good to have grown in that way.
What was the first thing you created together then? And can you remember? I mean, with stories like this, it's always, and it was an epiphany, and all of a sudden we looked at each other and thought, yes. But it's never, ever quite like that. What was the reality for you?
I got an MPC for my birthday, and I went down to a rehearsal with these guys because I'd made some of the beats for the live stuff on CD, and I just took it down because I wanted to play with it because I hadn't used one before, and then I started playing along with them, and it just seemed to be a lot easier than trying to keep up with a CD. So it just felt very natural. I mean, I wasn't really up for being on stage at that point, but neither were these guys, so we were on the same
boat. It's all right. And hey, he's our guy kind of moment. Was it a bit more organic than that?
We had asked Jamie to join a bit before as our drummer, and he just said no. He didn't want to be a drummer. He didn't want to be... I think your reasoning was you didn't think you were good enough to be...
I definitely wasn't good enough. It didn't feel right at the time, because these guys were doing something that already I could understand was really special.
Mm.
And it was nice. It was really nice to be able to be a part of it, but it needed to be something as interesting as what they were doing.
Because there was that... It's funny when bands get successful, like, little stories pop up and myths pop up that aren't necessarily true, but I read that first record, part of the ethos was it has to be able to be played live. We have to go into it, and it has to be able to be created by people at the same time. Was that true?
Yeah.
Oh, great.
That's exactly true. And that's why it sounds the way it does. And people said to us, oh, there's so much space in it, or it's so simple. Yeah. But it was really because... I don't know why or who came up with the idea, but we just had this sort of... I guess it was a rule in a way. Yeah. Just that, oh, everything that is in the demo or finally on the album is just exactly how we play it live. And Jamie really kept to that in the production of the album, which I love. And it means it's got a simplicity to it. And I think now with computers, you can just layer and layer and layer, and I've definitely found myself doing that. But I think I do sort of love that we just had that strong idea back then that shaped the sound. But it was more like happy accidents, because people would say, oh, you've really tried to be this minimalist thing. And we were like, oh, yeah. You know, I don't know. We weren't, like, going for that specifically. We obviously loved how it sounded, but it happened naturally.
Please don't say we're done when I'm not finished. I could give so much more. Make you feel like never before. Oh, welcome, listen, welcome to the floor.
It's been a while and you found someone better, but I've been waiting too long to give this up. The more I see, I understand, but sometimes I still need you. Sometimes I still need you.
Sometimes I still need you.
Sometimes I still need you.
Sometimes I still need you.
That was Heart Skipped a Beat by The XX, who are my guests here on The First Time this week.
Six Music.
Matt Everett's The First Time.
You used to have all the answers, and you still have them too. And we
Everett, and this is The First Time on Six Music, the show where we look at the key seminal musical moments in an artist's career and their life. And my guests this week are The XX, Romy Madley-Croft, Oliver Sim and Jamie Smith. And that track was VCR from the first XX album, The XX, in 2009, an album that the critics fell in love with. Can you remember the first kind of reviews you got? You remember the people's reaction to it coming out, that first record?
Yeah, like Romy was just saying, it was... a lot of people picking up on stuff, maybe came about by accident or just like from limitations. And, you know, we're being complimented on things that maybe we weren't entirely aware of, which kind of like promoting the album felt like an imposter a lot of the time, because it's like, oh, well done on creating all this space. And, you know, this space had come from the fact we were still learning to play our instruments. Me and Romy didn't have very loud voices, didn't make sense to make a big sound that we couldn't contend with. And I was like, oh God, these people think this was like a thought out thing.
I spent 2 months listening to Philip Glass. And we just came out like that.
Yeah.
But I did remember that, because we did GCSE music and I'd heard about Philip Glass, and someone said, Philip Glass said, oh yes. Like, you know, just like...
They were like comparison, like young marble giants. Only learnt about them through comparisons. And like done my research and listened to them since. But, you know, it was a strange experience hearing other people's like perceptions.
And then you get that thing where, and it happens with some bands, well, if you're very fortunate, where the sound that you've created kind of chimes with people in a certain way. You know, maybe they haven't heard it before, they haven't heard the tone of the lyrics or the production or the performances, and it starts to spread, and all of a sudden it's got nothing to do with what you did, and it's appearing on radio and stuff. Did that feel quite strange? Because then this thing that you've done in your world, to your rules, the context of that is now being changed, because it's now the soundtrack to something you've got nothing to do with. How did that feel?
It was super strange, but everything was at that time, like, it was just such a whirlwind. And we had no idea what was going on. It was such an exciting time. Yeah, I remember you'd like sign a deal so that TV can just use your music wherever they want. And then you just hear it on all these shows that you'd never expect it to be on. But it was, yeah, super exciting and weird.
Yeah, because it is, I like when it happens, it's almost like a pop art thing. It's like, here's this thing and it's getting used everywhere. It's like it's being screen printed and it's out there. And I love that. I think you shouldn't be precious about it. But at the same time, if you wrote lyrics and all of a sudden it's being used somewhere else, I can imagine that be maybe a difficult thing to come to terms with.
Well, the songs were so personal. I really don't think that when we were writing it, we really thought many people were going to hear it. I remember writing the lyrics to be cryptic enough that out of the 6 people that were coming to see us in the pub that night, one of the people that were there, the song was about for me. And I thought, I need to make this be cryptic enough that person is not going to realise.
Yeah.
But I'm going to have, like, got something out of my system. So I really don't think that we thought about that many people hearing it, if any. But then it kind of becomes something else, doesn't it? So after a while, you sort of just see these people singing it and it becomes, it's theirs now. So you sort of let go of it. But the weirdest out of context thing, I think when intro became the theme tune to the general the elections.
Mm. Yeah.
And then we got an invitation to come and play live on Newsnight.
I remember.
And we were just, I just think, and that song's an instrumental, so we're just standing on Newsnight playing an instrumental song. And I just have a really good memory of Jeremy Paxman. He looked at us and said, nice one, lads. And I was just like, thanks.
I've got to ask about the Mercury's just because it's coming up. But now there's been enough... It's a weird thing, the Mercury Prize, because it's very important to some people and other people really could not care about it at all. But it's because musicians often prize what it means to be nominated. And now it's been sufficient time from that. How does it feel looking back, going like... Imagining what it was like walking back onto that stage, walking onto the stage and kind of going, oh, we've won. Did it feel like a big deal?
Yeah. It had been... Like, the record had been out for a year.
Yeah.
And we were fully in the middle of it all. And, like, every week was just, like, a new, exciting thing that we weren't expecting. So I think, like, the Mercury's definitely took a while. Like, when we got nominated, I remember the record had been out a year, then it suddenly started charting the highest it had ever done. And, you know, we never thought we would chart. And we kind of, like, started to, like, really appreciate how much the Mercury's can do. Because I'd been introduced to so much music through them, like Anthony and the Johnsons. I remember when they won, I was just that suddenly really got into that record. It was a strange one. It took a while to sink in because we were still touring as well. We did a bit of touring after, then we came home and we had a chance to like settle, and it kind of all started to sink in a bit. It's really special, and you know, it's something that continuously comes up. Really, really, really thankful.
Because then, you know, then you start to have success in America. And success, I think, changes from whatever age you are, whatever place you are in your life, but also whatever country you are. Fame and success in Britain, I'm not just talking about scale, but it's very different in America.
Mm.
It's a different commodity. How did you deal with that? Did you deal with it well?
I think to go over there, I think we went to South by Southwest, and I was like, people know us. I don't know, it felt like something was shifting. And on that tour, then I think we went through to Coachella. It was a US tour, and then, I don't know, we ended up at Coachella. And then we got to Coachella, and we were playing at sunset on this stage. And there must have been 20,000 people or something insane. And we'd gone from playing, like, a few hundred people clubs. And I remember just looking out and being like, what's happened? What's happening? It was just such a visual, you know, I think at festivals you really get, like, such a visual moment where you can just suddenly see all these people that have come to see you. And it was just an incredibly special moment at sun going down, and just this moment where people seemed to know it and seemed to be responding to the songs like they did know who we were. People say, oh, you know, it happened really fast, and I guess in some ways it did, but there was a gradual feeling to it as well. We first toured the US supporting Friendly Fires in the autumn after their first album came out. I guess maybe that is quite fast from that tour to Coachella, but...
Well, there was a lot of build-up before.
Yeah.
To leave.
Everybody wants a piece of you, it's the cliche, isn't it? But the attention that you're getting all of a sudden is not necessarily what you started doing this for. You're just nodding.
I feel grateful for each other, though, because I think in that time I feel like you're with your oldest friends and we just kind of were in it together.
Mm.
It was obviously scary, but I felt kind of protected as well.
Is scary the right word?
Definitely.
Yeah, scary, exciting... The excitement is the overriding feeling for me.
Yeah.
Because, you know, if it was just purely scary, wouldn't have made it. would have given up. It was also new.
Yeah.
Like America. I had never been to America. This band took me to America for the first time. And I was like, this is the movies. This is, you know, the television that I've been watching, like, all my life. I'm in it. It was really, really exciting. And, you know, over time it's changed. And it still is extremely exciting, and I'm still really, like, curious about, like, new places and places we visit. But just that first moment is something that I don't think we'll ever replicate, because everything is just so brand new.
Yeah.
So brand new. And it's just, like, I think we just turned 20, but still kind of had that, like, teenage dramatic, like, feeling where everything is life-changing. You're huge.
Feeling all the emotions all the
time. You know, it's... You know, again, like, talking about this now, I feel excited.
Yeah.
It's it was a really, really, really special time. And I think we changed a lot in a very short period of time, because we were forced to.
Yeah.
Meeting people that we had kind of idolised as teenagers, going up, the stages were not even gradually, getting bigger and bigger. The trips were getting further away from home for longer periods of time, and we just kind of had to adapt quite quickly.
Who were the heroes then? Who did you meet?
Oh, quite a few. Oh, I remember, I remember playing in New York early 2010 at the Bowery Ballroom, and we'd played our show and we came into our dressing room, and just, like, on the sofa was Courtney Love, who I'd really idolise, and she's like, hey. I'm like, shut up. just because also she's just like such like a caricature of like a rock star to me.
She's very Courtney Love. Courtney Love is very Courtney Love.
That was a real like pinch myself moment, and she didn't disappoint.
Yeah, Courtney was big. I think for me, when I talk about that Coachella moment, the moment that I nearly imploded, I looked down and I saw Beyonce and Jay-Z in the photographer's pit. And I thought I was hallucinating. And Beyonce had an SLR camera and was taking pictures of us. And I just was like, I don't know what to do. But that was pretty special. And we have had the chance to meet them since, and that's been really special.
Yeah. Talking about important firsts, you've said that getting the Radiohead remix gig was a pretty big first for you.
Yeah.
Tell me a bit about their important guys.
They
musically.
Are. Yeah, still, to me, like, In Rainbows is one of my favourite records of all time. And I guess I was, like, in a period of figuring out how to do this on my own as well. And that offer came in to do that. And I think it's still probably the thing that I've spent most effort on.
Really?
Like, just on my own, being in my room for, like, a week, just making everything like very precisely perfect, and then doing a second version because I wasn't quite happy with it. Yeah, it was a big thing for me.
And then kind of going, and here it is, guys.
Yeah. Well, weirdly at the time, like, I wasn't even thinking about them listening to it, I don't think, or anybody listening to it. I just wanted to do it justice for myself. And also, I just really wanted to listen to all the parts of their songs separately.
Get the stairs. Talking about the kind of myths that surround bands, the kind of myth is that sort of coexist after this enormous sort of emotional high turned into like not exactly a maximum lull time, really. That you sort of lock yourself in a really gloomy room and had a pretty tough time. Is that myth true? Was it as hard as with hindsight?
I think it was. Is that fair?
Yeah.
I feel like when we were promoting that record, I think we were sugarcoating a bit and we didn't even realise quite how much.
Right.
Because everyone had said to us, second record, it's going to be really hard. And if someone says that to you enough, you're just like, no, it's not going to be hard. Our response to that first record doing so well was to just shut ourselves off. So we made the record just the three of us in a room. And, you know, normally there'd been people coming in and out. There was, you know, there was four of us in the band, and we had Roddy McDonald, who engineered and co-produced that first record. And it was just only the three of us. I think we felt like we needed to be really private. We didn't want to be too inspired by the outside world, right?
Yeah.
I mean, didn't want to be too influenced. And
which is a noble cause
and I think it just made quite a claustrophobic atmosphere.
I don't know if we realised how much so at the time. I think we were just like, this is how we're going to do it, we're doing it this way.
I just think when it came time to making I See You, our third record, we were like, let's not do it that way.
we've learnt from this.
And, you know, it really was like a very like open experience. We weren't just working in London, we were moving around, we were letting people in, we were playing stuff to even just our friends, and it just made it a much more enjoyable experience.
So, I See was made in Marfa, Texas, New York, Los Angeles, and Reykjavik. And whenever I see, like, that in a sort of something like that in a press release, has it all gone a bit Fleetwood Mac? They're flying around the world. We've got to do the tambourine in Malmo because that's, I mean, but yeah, it's reflected in that record. It's a different sounding record. I mean, do you really need to go to all those places? But a more open-minded experience then.
Yeah, it was the exact opposite to how we did the record before, and it was so much more fun. I'm glad that the record, the second record, sounds very honest, and it reflects exactly where we were, which is a weird place. And the third record also reflects exactly where we were, which is a lot more joyous some of the time.
I like
that. How joyous?
Some of the time.
I'm in love with it, intoxicated. I'm in rapture. From the inside, I can feel that you want to wake up high on it. Feeling suspended, I'm enamored. Way up in the sky, I can see that you want to.
I've been a romantic for so long.
The third album was definitely about doing things that scared us, but kind of willingly again. Like, we've always kind of done things that have scared us, I suppose, but it was good to get away from home, to stop being so precious, and to open the windows up, and just playing it to friends was a big thing. I think just being so private and nervous about it, and then just playing it to people, maybe sometimes, I think there's a lot of musicians I've spoken to said the same thing. You play a song to a friend or anyone, and even before they've said, or I like it or I don't like it, you've fully got a feeling of whether you like it more or what you need to change just by the act of playing it to someone in the same room, and how beneficial that is to just hearing it, imagining it through their ears and sort of judging yourself in that way. You can completely come up with new ideas.
That's really interesting. I never thought about that. Yeah, like presenting something to someone else. Are they going to like it? Oh, yeah, I think they're going to like it. I know they're going to like this. Changes the way you think about what you've
but
done.
The feel, but then they haven't even said if they like it or not, but you just get this feeling. And then they might say to you afterwards, oh, it's great, but you've had a realisation that, oh, no, I really need to change that lyric or something. Just those little things we learn just from experience. I think when we were making the first album, we didn't ever imagine we'd be going to Texas and LA and Reykjavik to do it all, but it was fun to have that experience. And there is something about the three of us getting out of London and just being very much friends away from home, and it really brings us close together. So I think that was kind of more of the action of that, of like an exciting trip together, because London's our home and, you know, there's distractions. You can be like, oh, I need to do this life thing. So it's quite good to be away, just to fully get sink into the music.
It's fun to go on trips anyway.
Yeah.
Going back a bit, you mentioned the live thing, but yeah, there was that, having seen you live, you know, there was a kind of a point when it changed. And, you know, the production, which is always interesting, kind of got more focused, and the way that you moved and the way that you presented yourself kind of felt it shifted in a kind of really positive way. You became a different live band. And I think people really responded to that. Were you aware of that happening?
No.
Right.
I think it's to do, really, just to do with looking up. It was looking up and being able to, like, see people's reactions, and then I kind of felt a bit more, like, at ease. I was like, oh, people are enjoying themselves. and that put me at ease. And I just felt a lot more relaxed, and I could, like, play with the idea of performing. Before that, I was there to play the songs. And performing is something I really enjoy now. I really enjoy. Like, the satisfaction I get from songwriting and being in the studio is quite, like, slow-burning. Being up on stage is just so instant. And, you know, like Romy was saying, it's been a year now since we did a show, and I miss it. I really do miss it. It gives me a sort of confidence, and it's a different, like, version of myself that I kind of miss.
Jamie, how do you feel about that?
I love it now as well. I guess, like, DJing in between the first and second albums, or just after the first album, forced me to perform because there was nobody else to perform in front of me. And it also made me realise how much I love dancing, and that I could do it whether I was playing or in the club. And I just took that over to the live thing as well, and it just made it a lot more fun. I just feel like if your dance as well. It kind of, the anxiety goes out of your feet as you're dancing.
I really like that. I think there was a moment in time when people would say to me, I think because of, you know, Oliver and I mentioning a few times how we were looking down a lot, I wasn't necessarily always looking over to my left at Oliver. So after the show, sometimes people would say, God, Oliver moves now. Oliver, he really moves. He's really, like, performing. I was like, is he? And then I started looking and I was like, oh my God, this is good. Okay, I need to, like, I need to up my game a bit here. So I started swaying around a little bit. And then, yeah, over time, I've sort of gotten into it. And sometimes I just feel just so embarrassed, like, moving on stage. But it also feels great. Mm. But it's a point where you just get past it, and, you know, and I do really enjoy it.
And where are we now? So, you know, it's been really cool to talk about the history of the band, talk a lot about 10th anniversary. 10th anniversary.
I feel like the overriding feeling is that I feel like we seem so old. Like, all of we were just like, my 30th birthday is next few weeks. Like, I feel like we're just like talking like we're granny and grandpas. But we're not. A lot's happened in 10 years, which I'm really proud of. But yeah, we're just all making new music now.
Yeah, so I mean, whereas if the lead up or the creation of every record has got a distinct kind of tone, personality to it, or rules or whatever, what's on the whiteboard for the next record? Oh, look at you, no one wants to say anything.
No, it's not even, like, withholding. I don't know. I think right now, I think we're all working, we're, like, hanging out a lot, but we're working pretty independently, as if we're kind of making our own records. Mm. And then I'm sure we'll have the moment of, like, really coming together and kind of, like, I've done a lot of work with Romy in the past couple of weeks, I've done a lot of work with Jamie, but we haven't had that moment of the three of us being in a room together and working. I get Romy's feeling of, like, talking about the past. I do feel like it was a long time ago, but still, like, very much, like, figuring it out and feel, like, very curious. So though it does feel like it's been a long time since the first record, I just feel like we're still new to it all. I still feel just, like, a different kind of excitement. I don't feel like a seasoned professional yet.
No. Yeah, but you never want to feel like, yeah, we've got this music thing.
Yeah.
No, you never want to feel like that.
That's the kiss of death, I suppose. I feel like when people say that they're not nervous anymore, that always seems like a bit of a red flag.
I think it means you don't care.
Yeah.
Right?
I think that sounds about right. Because, you know, I think the nerves come from really caring. Even though if you've done loads of shows in a row and you kind of get in the swing of it, you never know what the audience is going to react like. You're in a different part of the world. They might just really be not into it. You can't take that for granted.
A desire to release something this year? Desire to not worry about it at all and see what happens? How do you see it unfolding?
I mean, there is a desire to release stuff, but the stuff hasn't come yet, so...
There's no stuff to release.
There's stuff on the way, but really, like, I'm working hard on working out how to live at home in one place. I haven't done that before, and I'm enjoying it and, like, figuring a lot of stuff out. And it's nice to go to the same studio every day, and it's gradually coming.
And the last question. We always ask everyone, it's difficult because there's three of you, but we always ask for you to choose the last song that we end the show on, so it can be anything. And we don't give you warning because then people think about it too much. So I don't know who's going to pick it.
Intro.
A couple of the big American, like, dudes, actually, we'll play track 4 of my new record. And you're like, okay, we'll do that. You can play anything in the world. But
what's a song that means a lot to us combined?
We're all looking into each other's eyes, hoping that they're going to just appear.
Young Hearts?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's good.
Candy Staten, Young Hearts Run Free. We played that as the song that ended our show, every show of the ICU tour. Basically, once we've come off stage, it played. And what was so beautiful about it is the whole audience turned into a dance floor. And often we just peek around the curtain and just see people basically ballroom dancing to this song. And it just felt like a really, like, nice to see this moment of people connecting. And then sometimes we'd be dancing off down the hallway, just so at the end of the show, just sort of feeling a sense of relief and excitement. So we love this song.
That's a good place to finish. Thanks, guys. It's been really good to
speak to you.
Thanks so much.
What's the sense in sharing this one and only life? Ending up just another lost and lonely wife. You count up the years and they will be filled with tears. Love only breaks up to start over again. You'll get the babies, but you
takes music.
Mishmashing the sound and see what you get.
Straight up bangers, obscure gems, and long forgotten favorites.
Well, we don't have a set list. We're trying to ensure that every show is different.
This is Alt Noughties on BBC Sounds.
Team.